Let's get cracking. Keith Dugdale, long time friend, long time business colleague, awesome guy, a lot of good ideas, and a successful author as well, Smarter Selling. But he is really good at getting the right people to talk to him. And when he gets them in the room, he can hold a very, very good business development conversation. So, based in Brisbane in Australia, without any further ado, I'll hand you over to Keith and he can get cracking.
Thanks, Peter. The original premise for this get-together was around those going to a certain conference in the States later this year. And a conversation that was had around, okay, so how do we make sure we actually get to meet people we want to meet at that conference? Now, I know things have kind of gone about 90 degrees sideways from that starting proposition. But still, the call is all around how do you get meetings with the people you want to meet? Before I start, what I'd like to do is a really quick run round, and I'll call the name out of the person I want to speak. I'm going to call for Pete an hour and a half. What's the?
Regularly an hour for this kind.
Okay. Really quickly going around the screen as I see it. One quick sentence from each person as to what will make this a good use of your time. So you when you walk away from this call, what do you want to have got from it that's going to make you go away going, God, that was good. Eric.
Play with there we go. Sorry.
All right.
I shut myself up and then I can't stop. So good use of my time would be, basically the premise for this would, you know, being how do you get the right people? I think part of it, there've been some discussions in the past in terms of how do we filter people who we might just engage with, but how do we start to do a quick filter right up front so that we don't spend equal time with every person who is unlikely to provide the kind of, lead that we really look for.
Okay, so that's about getting the right person. Excellent, thank you. Mark?
Thank you. Hey, Keith. Hey. ROI is my thing. I just want to make sure I get the most value out of this thing. So any tips I can pick up at all, I'm keen for.
It's brilliant, thank you. Aaron, and your partner in crime?
Aaron and Nate, go for it.
Yeah.
Actually, Nate and I are supposed to be having a one-on-one here, so sorry, Nate.
Hey, yeah. Thanks, everyone, for joining. I would say... a great outcome of this meeting will be enhancing our strategy pre-ATD, pre this conference. And I would say if we walk away from that conference with 8 solid leads, 4 of them end up in our pipeline where we're working them with good chance of closing in the next year and a half, that would be worth it for us.
Okay, fantastic. Terry?
If I could learn how to get more meetings with HR directors, that would be it, yeah.
More with HR directors. Okay, very good. Thank you. Ricky?
What's the best way to approach the C-level?
Ah, excellent. Thanks, Ricky. Jim?
I'm actually just very, very open to learn. I don't have a huge need right now that I'm thinking of. I'm just the empty cup.
Don't keep the learning in the box. Yeah, I know. Catherine.
All right. So thank you so much for hosting this. I guess I want to come away knowing that I'm speaking to the right person.
Ah, excellent. Thank you. Tim?
So a couple of things me is firstly just brushing up on some stuff that I already know. Always a good reminder and hearing it from the author's mouth. And also, I noticed yesterday in the sheet that Pete sent out to us that there are a few new things, or is another column in there which hasn't been in the stuff that I've done with you before. So I'm intrigued by that.
Excellent, thank you.
I'm here to partly just to learn, but one thing at the top of my mind would be qualifying and disqualifying links.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah. Anthony, been a while.
Hi there. Good to see you again.
And you?
For me, salespeople, well, they still see us as salespeople. We're just phoning in or contacting them and they don't see us as a consultant. So how to actually transition, in spite of having read the book and being accredited with your program, I still find it difficult to get people to stop seeing me as somebody with a sales agenda.
Very good, thank you. Rashini.
Hi. So I tend to rush through, in fact, I try and avoid events like this because I don't really know how to capitalize on them. So anything you share with me is going to be really useful. Thank you.
Okay. That makes it easy. Good. Thank you. Francis.
For me, I meet a lot of people who are potentially really valuable customers, but I never see myself as somebody who might actually leverage on that connection and create value out of it.
Okay.
So after meeting Terry, I thought, he's very good at it. So I thought maybe there might be a thing or two I might learn and maybe get even better than him at it.
Virginia.
She did pop in the chat here, practical tips and tools on ways on business development generally.
Have we had, is Sharmini?
Making the book come alive. I've read the book. I'd like to see it in action.
Oh, God, that puts the pressure on. So there's a combo there. It's partly around the right person, making sure we are speaking to, or how do we identify the right person, partly about how do we make sure we're dealing with the right person, and then how do we make sure we actually get the meeting, and then so that's kind of, okay, so that's 6 weeks work. We've got 50 minutes. Okay. Let me start at the very beginning. And some of the things I say might upset a couple on the call, but I don't have time to do the nice, soft, gently stuff to make it realize I'm doing it with good intent. I'll start then with stuff that for you, some of you will be very, very old and familiar. And it's language that's nicked from Miller Hyman, but is so relevant. It's an increasingly relevant. And that is around the role of the buyer that you're dealing with. And it's just a nice, simple way of thinking about it. So if I'm a IT salesperson selling computers and I target a new client, the natural person I'll go and talk to is the IT function. The natural place in what we do, which is training ostensibly, is to go and talk to the HR function. And the last person I'll ever talk to is the HR function. Because using the Miller-Hyman language, they fulfill what's called the technical buyer role. And at the end of the day, the technical buyer's role is to get as much of whatever they procure for as little cost as possible. And so you need to have a relationship, but at the end of the day, they manage a budget. The people you really need to get to are the economic buyer.
Like it's the rest of us. So
yeah. Okay,
just
cool.
As a really quick summary, you're going for the economic buyer.
The economic buyer who manages the business, not the technical buyer who manages the budget.
Right.
And then for most people on this call, the technical buyer is the HR director or HR manager. And they are the last person on, as I said, on God's earth I would ever talk to. And the reason for that is essentially whatever you're selling, the higher up the corporate tree, they see a value for it. And the closer you are to the front end of the business, the more likely they are going to want to buy it and pay for it. And so the key thing is to make sure that you are talking to the right person. In a brand new client and a target client, your first touch point should always be the economic buyer. And for a lot of that people, that presents a massive challenge because part of what goes through your head, and I've just had 2.5 days in Melbourne talking to a client about this, is why would the CEO want to talk to me? All I do is training or whatever it happens to be. And that's the main issue. If the value they bring to an organization is limited by the value they can bring to the HR function, for example, and there is trouble there. And the trouble usually comes around, you've got lots of competition and price is critically an issue. And we're talking primarily about setting up new relationships here. So I won't talk at all about shifting a relationship you've got. When it's a brand new client, always go to the economic buyer first. But that for a lot of people is quite scary because the CEO, for example, knows about a lot of things and might not want to talk to me as someone who sells this training. No, but I'm in exactly the same boat. We sell, at the end of the day, sales training, if you want to simplify it right down. And yet, I might sometimes talk to the head of business development. I might talk to the head of sales. I'll usually talk to the CEO, CFO, CEO in an organization.
And but to do that, and for them to then want to talk to you, you then need to think, okay, what is it that would be value to them? Okay, so that's kind of identifying who. But if you take a step back before that, so more strategically, it's about maybe being very clear on the clients you want to work with. And it's something that I see small and large businesses really bad at.
So economic buyers go for the people who will pay up. And I suppose there's a real importance for that in the current environment. Actually selling anything right now is going to be interesting, but talking to the right people is even more important. So keep going there, Keith.
And you know, I've got a live example of this at the moment in terms of the importance. So Australia hasn't been hit really with coronavirus yet, and yet everyone is panicking. The professional services firms were already laying off leaders and the like. My main client at the moment, my relationship is with the number two in the business until Monday night. Now it's with the number one in the business. If it hadn't been, my program would have been cancelled because the HR function has been asked to cut all costs. And so, it does make a real difference. The thing that Tim alluded to that is that he won't have come across having worked with us before is if you look at those forms, on the front page, it refers to a pest analysis. Now, most of you probably will have come across pests before in different contexts, but probably not in this context. And the aim here, and even Nate, I think in your situation, if you can narrow down the people who you want to meet at the conference, then I would be doing this on every person you actually want to meet. So you do a pest analysis, but you do it at four levels. So what you're looking at now, if you all flick to the back page, you will find some hints within another, so a kind of sample pest analysis with hints of the sort of things you're trying to put in each of these boxes. And the whole idea here is you're trying to put yourself in that client's shoes before you even send an email to get a meeting or before you even meet them. And it's not about filling the boxes in any shape or form. This is driving curiosity to, if I was that person, so you've got the first row is the person, in that role, so whatever their job description is, the second row, in that entity, so that's the organization, in that industry, what are likely to be the things that are top of mind? So, and this for me, this normally for each person I'm trying to do this with, it might take a couple of hours over 2 or 3 weeks. So I keep on coming back to it. And what you're trying to do is see if you can identify, if you were that person, what are likely to be the things that they would care about right now? Because you're not trying to sell them your product. You don't want to sell them your product at this stage. It's incredibly unlikely that the thing that falls out of this analysis is your product, especially if you're dealing with the C-suite. So the onus then is on how do I build a relationship with this person where they genuinely trust me, because you're being genuinely helpful. And this, there's no faking it in this. This is about genuinely caring about that person. And I'll say that as well. If you have got a list of companies that you want to work with and you actually don't give a damn about them, you shouldn't be working with them anyway. So this is, I'm really intrigued with working with this company for whatever reason. I'm intrigued by the industry or whatever it is. Then when you do your pest analysis, once you've identified the things that are most important to, you think are most important to that person, you still might get it wrong, but you've got a much greater chance of getting it right. Then it's okay, how do I potentially give them any value with regard to these things in a conversation? I'm not talking over a period of time. Can I go and do some research? Do I know other people who might be able to help in these areas? What are the sorts of things that might be helpful to that person? If you can't think of anything and you're not prepared to put in the work to deliver that, then you are not going to get the meeting. And even if you did get the meeting, you're going to be either kicked out or delegated straight back to where you don't want to be. The same principle does apply, actually, even if you are going to go and see the HR manager. Because what it can surface quite quickly, let's say you are dealing with the HR manager rather than the CEO, if you start surfacing all these things that are top of mind for them, and none of them in any way linked to the thing that you're dealing with, the thing you're selling, don't waste your time. just not, it's not worth it. But if you're doing it with a CEO, that's going to be a long stretch. So I'm very comfortable in doing this and then not pretending to be an expert in something, but I'll give you a hyper extreme example of this. Okay. This is a very extreme example, but they're not always this extreme. Working with a partner in one of the accounting firms, he wanted to get three meetings. He told me to get three meetings with the three most difficult CEOs in his part of the world. One of them was the CEO of a very heavy mining haulage company, so heavy mining train company. Never spoken to him before, never had any communication whatsoever. And once we'd done the analysis, what came to light was one of the key focuses for that CEO was women in leadership. At which point, my guy had palpitations because he knew nothing about it. But he was genuinely interested because in that industry, in that part of the world, women in leadership is not really something that has a strong history. But my guy, John, got intrigued by this and then started to do research about other organizations in similar industries in other parts of the world who have already gone down that path, that then allowed him to draft an email with me sitting behind him. It won't be exactly right, but I'll give you a sense of what this email was like. So, dear Lance, because that was his name, from the press, it seems that one of the critical things you want to leave with your legacy is 50% women in leadership. And I'm genuinely intrigued by how you're going about that in this part of the world. I'm very keen to have a conversation about it if you are interested. If you are interested, I'd love to hear what drove that and where you're up to, and also what you see as the kind of the main blocks moving forward. I can then share with you what I have seen other organizations in other parts of the world do in this field. Hopefully by the end of the meeting, you'll have one or two new ideas that you believe will genuinely help you move forward. Any sounds of interest, suggest when. Regards, John. In the meantime, here's a report I managed to pull out of Canada of a mining company who seemed to be on the similar path. Bear in mind, the partner that I'm dealing with is a liquidator. He has nothing to do with women leadership. It's all about understanding what's most quick. And they had the meeting, and down the track, they're literally millions of dollars better off. It's all about, do I actually care about this client? And if I do, I need to find out what they care about. And if you think about how I started this conversation, albeit it's been very broken up, it was about finding out from each of you what is the one thing in an hour you want to get from this conversation. Now, this was within a narrower context of the subject matter we put forward, but it's the same principle. How do you make sure your prospect, in this case, gets the maximum return on investment from the time they spend with you? And that almost certainly means you are not going to talk about your product or offering at all, because the chances of them wanting that right now are almost nil. Comments on that before I go any further?
This is Terry here. If the information is not publicly available, how do you find out what the person is interested in?
It's a great question. So, you know, and that's one of the reasons we've got four rows in the pest analysis. So you've got the individual. So when you're working in a large organization, it's much easier to get information about a person because lots of people between them might know something. In some parts of the world, people put an awful lot on their LinkedIn and Facebook profiles. In certain parts of the world, they don't. Like Belgium, it's really hard to get information from that level. For the role, in terms of their role, so let's say their role is HR manager, I would be getting on the phone to the guys on this call. What are the trends that are facing HR managers in all different industries around the world? What are the things that they are really facing right now? Because through that, you might get some insights as to A, will they talk to you? And B, what are the things that I could bring some advice to them? And so my email would be talking about, you know, it seems across the world in your industry that HR managers are facing real budget pressure, but also expected to achieve more. And then you're following the same principle. Make sure they, if that is a key issue for them, make sure that HR manager leaves that meeting with some new ideas and maybe some contact details that they can use that will help them in their job. And it has nothing to do with your offering. And one of you, when we started this, said, how do I get seen? I think it was Anthony. More as a consultant and not as a salesperson. that's how you do it. Your entire focus is, how do I make sure they walk out of every interaction with me thinking, God, that was useful. And the real, if you play the long game on this, the real beauty of this is, and I've got some of these around Australia, where I might not do any work for someone who is of high power and influence in an organization, but they really trust me because they seek my counsel on things, but they know a lot of other people like that. And you get, and all the, wherever you live in the world, that level in organizations, they all connect. They all know each other. And once you build that reputation as someone who's there to help a business, even though they might not buy your service, then that reputation gets around really quickly. Going back to your question, the main line, if you can't get any information about the individual, the most important row, well, two rows probably in that personality, the bottom two, you can usually get information about a company. You can get information about councils. Go to their website, go to their, you know, if you're going to go see a senior executive in an organization and you haven't read their annual report, you're really exposing yourself. Yeah. Industry. What's happening in industry is so important. When you look at the feedback that the big consulting firms are getting at the moment from the market, and the stats are so compelling. The number one thing that leaders in business are looking for is industry insights. What are people doing in mine or similar industries around the world? Anyone can find that. You don't need to be an expert in mining. You need to have an understanding of what mining companies in other parts of the world are doing if you're going to go see a mining company. So in my world, and I probably spend 80% of my time in professional services, I'm always keeping abreast of what's happening in the legal industry in the States, what's happening in the engineering industry around the world, and then sharing these insights across my client base. And if you ask most of my clients, what do they value? It's not the training that hopefully they do value that, because they pay for it. It's that they value all the other stuff. It's the connections to other people who might give them insights, connections to other people who might have services they can buy, connections to peers and competitors that they can learn from. And I think it's a mind, certainly in my experience working with these professional firms, it's a mindset that is not prevalent in most people. That's not saying it's not prevalent in the guys on this call, but it's, I need to want to work with this person, this company for a really good reason because it intrigues me or whatever. Then I need to find out how on earth I can give value. Hopefully at some point, and obviously you're not going to do this just broadly around the world. You need to be talking to someone who at some point hopefully will want your service, but just not now. And I think that's one of the main challenges. If you're going to a new prospect and you start with the technical buyer, trying to get that technical buyer to take you to the economic buyer is really hard. But if you start with the economic buyer and get it right, things happen real quick and genuinely at a far higher charge out rate. I would suspect in Australia, the difference in charge out rates that you can charge doing what we do, essentially, when I'm working with an HR function to working with the boss, is about 100%, literally. HR managers roll their eyes when I talk about what I charge. CEOs don't bat an eyelid. If I go back, way back, when we first set up 17 years ago, David and my mission, one of the things we set up in the first year was to have a global contract with Adidas. And Perry and a couple of others were actually involved in that at some point, I think. And within 3 months, we were sitting in Adidas's house in Germany. And that was because we were singularly focused on that and what relationships we had, what intel we could get that would actually get us into that level of relationship. And it worked really well for us. It worked fantastic well for us. But it's not done by accident. It's not done by shotgun. Yeah, it's done by very clear, these are the organizations you want to work with and these are the key people. So you spend more time on fewer targets, preparing, getting it right, more time preparing for every conversation, more time. You know, I might spend an hour, even when I've done 2 hours on that pest analysis, I might spend an hour, even 2 hours sometimes, just wordsmithing the first email But we work on an 80 to 85% success rate of getting a CEO to come back to us on our first email. So I want to make damn sure when I'm cutting down the numbers I'm sending to, I get it right. But you don't always get it right. And I think in those conferences, there's a complexity in there that makes it more difficult. But, and I know this isn't the case for the ATD from what I've heard this time, it has been in the past. We've had fantastic success with those conferences that once you register, you can get the names of the attendees. And what a French colleague, the guy who runs Europe for us at the moment, actually now, at this stage he worked for an engineering firm in Canberra, did, was he identified, I think it was the 15 people going to the conference who he wanted to meet. He followed exactly what I've just told you and sent that version of a note to those 15 through their LinkedIn details, and 13 out of the 15 agreed to meet him out of conference. So it does work in those contexts where you can get the details of who's attending. You could probably, Nate and others going to these conferences, you can probably do a bit of guesstimation in there. But I actually think that, I think Jim, you said you're going to walk around, I don't know if it's ATD, with the, literally walk around the box on your head. I suspect that if you get that right in terms of the walking around and have done, and can somehow identify who you want to speak to visually, etc., you might get more success than being passively at a stand, if that makes sense. Yeah, if I can identify who I want to talk to and go and talk to them, it's probably more successful. So, Nate, what I would be doing where you've got a stand, I believe, is I'd be making sure, yeah, you've got a stand, it looks great. And your people need to be having conversations with people who walk up to the stand, not just about your product. They need to be asking the questions that would help mentally them figure out what's going on for that person. So rather than say, hi, yeah, we've got this great product, you should look at this, it's really exciting, other clients love it. It's, but before we talk about my product, do you mind telling me a bit about what your role is in your organization and what are maybe the three things right now that are top of mind? And so they're already starting to have a consulting conversation at the stand at ASTD, and they might never talk about the product, because what I want those people who walk up to the stand to do is to walk away from the stand going, I want to talk to him or her again. I don't want them walking away thinking, that product's quite interesting, because there's a lot of interesting products, but there's not many interesting people. That's what I want them to walk away with. But that, again, is quite hard, because psychologically it's much easier if I'm at a stand at a conference and I'm the person at the stand and someone walks up looking all interested and excited and they've got their lanyard on, it's much easier for me to talk about my product because I know my product than it is for me to ask a question of that person I've never met and I have absolutely no idea what they're going to say. Because then I might look stupid because I don't know how to respond to what they say. In that situation, I'll kind of role play it here. It might be, look, before we get into that, do you mind telling me right now in your role, what are maybe the three most critical things? Because I don't want to waffle on about my product. It's of no use at all. But let's say, oh, we've got massive problems with turnover of staff. We've got some real issues around technology, and we do need to improve the presentation skills that our people have got. I said, okay, so those three, what right now, is presentation skills top or is one of the other two? And they turn around and say, well, it's staff turnover. So I'm sitting there at a stand selling Think on Your Feet, and these guys want to, saying the most important thing is staff turnover. At that point, I would say, look, I'm no expert in staff turnover, but I've got a whole bunch of clients who are having very similar issues, and some of them are doing some really cool things to make sure they engage their staff more, empower them more, and keep them longer. Would you be interested at all in speaking to any of those other organizations? What's this person going to say? They're going to say, oh, hell yes. That's probably a lot more useful 30-second, two-minute interaction with your guy on the stand than talking about your offering. Now, you may or may not get into your offering, but I don't care. I want them to go away giving me their business card saying, we need to chat, rather than me pushing onto them my business card and a little brochure. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's really hard to get this over.
Yeah. No, it sounds fabulous. I love that. You know.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
How do I get your book, Keith?
$7,400 a copy.
No, I'll take 25.
Excellent.
I got a couple of questions. So when your guy was using LinkedIn to target particular people he wanted to talk to at the conference, if he wasn't originally connected to them, how did he write to them in the first instance? Like, did he have a limit of the number of words he could use, or what was his opening gambit? Did he just try
he did what we call the IWU, which is basically what I verbally went through very briefly earlier in a LinkedIn message. Now, I assume that Julien, being Julien, would have had whatever the LinkedIn premium thing is that allows you to contact people who aren't already connected. But don't talk to me about the technological aspects, Peter.
No, that's okay. I mean, that's
way above my pay grade.
Yeah, if you've got premium, you can probably send longer messages and things like that. Oh, Virginia's asked, what is IWU? Why don't you do that while I try and remember what else I was going to ask?
So the IWU is basically what I went through quickly when I was doing that dummy verbal email from John at the accounting firm to the grumpy old CEO of the heavy haulage firm. Essentially, so let me quickly run through it then. So when you're sending an email to get a meeting, and this takes, if I'm running a two-day workshop, this takes 4 to 5 hours to get through, so this is really skimming across the surface. The email's going to be really short, and it has to capture the love and attention of the person receiving instantly. So if you've done your pest analysis and you've identified, you're pretty sure this is a critical issue, that obviously has to get on the subject line. So it might be, if I was writing to an accounting firm right now, my subject line might be maintaining margin in a increasingly price-sensitive market, something like that. The I statement, and then you break the email in its purest form, and obviously you break this up depending, you change according to exactly who you're writing to in the situation, etc. But in its simplest form, three components to the email. I, which is the intent of the meeting. This is why we're meeting. And so my I in that situation might be something along the lines of, dear Mary, I work with a number of professional service firms around the world, and it seems to me there's increasing pressure on maintaining margin. And I was wondering whether that was a subject that would be of some interest to talk about. So that's clearly the intent of the meeting, to talk about that. Then you go to the second component, which is the we, and the we is almost a soft verbal agenda, the sequence of conversation. So in that case, it might be, if that sounds of interest to you, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are currently in terms of the price pressure and maintaining margin, and what plans you've got in play. Once I understand those, I can share what a couple of lawyers and one engineering firm that I know of are doing that are really interesting in this area, both here in Australia, but also in the US. And the reason I'm pointing to Australia and the US, I want to maximize the chance that when the person receives this email, they're going, oh, I know about Australia, but I don't know what they're doing in the US. That might be quite intriguing. Yeah, so it's that sequence of conversation. Client talks first, then me. And then the you statement, I can't do this on the phone as I normally do, but the rhetorical question. The you statement is the value that you, the client, will get from this interaction. Not the value of working with Keith, not the value of the report or the training. This is the return on investment that you'll get for spending an hour of your life with me, an hour you will never get back. So you have to nail it in this you statement. You have to, at the end of this you statement, when they read it, they have to be going, I'd be stupid not to go to that meeting. And so in that situation, my you statement might say something like, hopefully by the end of the meeting, you'll have 2 or 3 new ideas that you are confident will really help you with maintaining margin. And also maybe the contact details of a couple of organizations who are in the similar boat. And if I'm there and if I've got it right and I'm the recipient and that issue is a major issue for them, why wouldn't they give an hour to talk about that? But that's scary because now people go, but I don't know what law firms in the US are doing. No, you need to go and find out. And it's actually not hard. Finding this stuff out nowadays is not hard. The first port of call is always Harvard Business Review. And then you kind of migrate out from there. So that's what the IWU is, but it's not as simple as I've just portrayed it, but you know, in the time available. I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's great. Virginia said thank you in the chat box there.
Thank you.
Yeah. What I was wondering about, I vaguely recall hearing this in a previous end-to-end conversation about ATD or whatever we're talking about. as to opening questions, you know, when you someone walks up to your booth or when you walk over to them because they're looking at your booth, but they haven't said anything to you. And I remember one or two, I think Nate and Aaron have had to bug out, unfortunately, but I remember they had some interesting questions they used to lead with. Does anyone else have any good leading questions that they ask people that have nothing to do with their product, that engages people?
In my booth, it's people, because I've got all these pictures of boxes. I don't stand with a box on my head all day, but the thing that they're trying to figure it out. And so my first question is, are you curious? And then they usually say yes. And then one question I started asking towards the end was, what are you hoping it is? Right. And so that's kind of a way of getting to what they're looking for.
That's neat. I like that. What were you hoping it was?
Yeah. What are you hoping this is? You know, because it stops them in their tracks when they see these, you know, boxes with people's faces. And then I found that was an easy way to get them to give a quick 15-second answer, because in general we got about a minute and a half to 2 minutes to figure out whether or not we want to talk to each other.
And I think that's an important point there, is that apart from anything else, Jim, you have to be different and interesting. And you know, you could almost walk around 10 stalls, find out what they do, and if you did the opposite, you probably get a better success rate than the others, because they're all doing the same. Yeah. And so I think Jim's got a different way they're going about finding out what is the context within which they've walked up to your stand. Yeah. Why have they walked up to your stand? And so if you understand that and show you give a damn about why and the context and how this is relevant compared to other things, rather than go straight into, thanks for coming to talk to me, can I help you understand what I've got? Yeah, it's... The frustrating thing, I think, is that those... In our limited experience of those conferences, when you're on the stand, it's great fun. We've had a blast before. We've talked to so many people, had good, interesting conversations, largely driven around our thing, as opposed to if we went now, it would be a fundamentally different approach. Although we wouldn't go now, because we would just go for the one-on-one rather than the conference approach.
Yeah. Virginia has put a couple of good questions in there too. What keeps you awake right now? And if you had a magic wand, what would you change about your organization, people, team, whatever you know, word you want to use there?
I think the keeps you awake at night is done. I think it certainly had its time, but I think if you can come up with different versions of it that lead to the same mental process, if that makes sense.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, because all of these things have a point at which people are just almost waiting for it to be asked.
Sorry, Keith, keep going.
Yeah, carry on.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure if we had time, but another request in the chat box was to... learn a bit more about other parts of the pest and the shape stuff you've got there. But we literally only have about 5 more minutes. I'm not sure if that's worth even getting
into. Yeah, I mean, the pest is probably easier to explain, but that can be done in emails if anybody wants that. But the shape is much harder. And so if I do a very quick overview, most sales processes are very linear. Yeah, some of you will have been through Spin and Neil Rackham and what have you. Very prescriptive, and the aim is to sell this. Cause pain, sell it to fix the pain. This is almost the antithesis of that. So we've got labels around the types of question, but the labels are only there for a training purpose. They're not there for a process. And essentially, you've got 5 different types of question in our world. You've got surface questions, which just get you data. You know, how's the business? How many people you got? All that kind of stuff. Hunt questions, which is where you're explicitly looking to understand a negative connotation from the client. So a problem they've got, a challenge they've got. By the way, this is not linear. You do not go SHAPE ever, because that then becomes a script and prescriptive. This is about reading the person you are dealing with. Are they big picture or detail? Are they opportunity, very positive, or are they very risk averse? And then changing the question accordingly. we've then got adjust questions, which are making sure you are on the client's track. So 15 minutes into a meeting, you've been talking about, I don't know, the staff turnover for 15 minutes. I want to make sure that this is a conversation that is really critical to the client and we haven't accidentally just end up on a conversation that is easy to have. So that point an adjust question might be, look, we've been talking about staff turnover for 15 minutes here. I just want to make sure of all the things in front of you right now, is staff turnover really the most critical? Because if it's not, I'd far rather find out what is and maybe have a conversation around that. So you're resetting the meeting to make damn sure they do walk away going, that was really useful. That's the adjust question. You've got the paint question, which is making sure you understand the outcome they're trying to achieve. And that could be an outcome that's really narrow and small and related to the thing at hand, or it could be much broader. And I'll give you an example of that in a minute. But the reason it's so important to be able to tune in, and very few people naturally do it, to when your client is telling you an outcome they're trying to achieve as opposed to a challenge they face, is that once someone's actually decided they need to achieve the outcome, they are A, far more engaged in it and in the conversation and more likely to do something about it than if they're just listing challenges. You know, so for every 10 challenges I have in my life, probably 8 of them bug me, but I'm not going to change them. 2 of them I want to change. You need to find out what those 2 are. And the way to do that often is to ask either the adjust or the paint question. And then you've got the engage question where at the end where you're just saying to the client, right, clearly staff turnover is a big issue for you. What are your thoughts about what should happen next? So rather than me saying this is what I'll do, which is you taking control again, this is about giving them control. And everything we do in the program, everything that we talk about is all about you've got to give the other person control. So if I come back quickly to that hunt and paint, hunt is to surface challenges, paint is to surface future outcomes. Let's imagine I'm talking to someone and they say to me the following sentence. Keith, you would not believe how bad staff motivation is in this place. We've got 20% turnover of staff. People are turning up late, leaving early. It's just shocking. It's a massive challenge. My head now goes to, okay, I need to ask a paint question to get a sense of how important this is to them. What sort of person are they? If they're a very detailed person, maybe an HR person, very detailed, my response to that sentence might be, you have just mentioned that your staff turnover is 20%. What would you like it to be? So future positive, they'll react to that. If I ask that question of a big picture person, strategic thinker, who's the CEO, that is not engaging at all. So in the same situation, my paint question back to a CEO might be, clearly you're not happy with your staff turnover. If you fixed it, what impact would that have on the business? Completely different question that's going to much more likely to engage someone at that level, and I'll get much more information back. I'll also get a sense as to whether it's really important. If he turns around and says, oh, we've always got back to staff turnover, it's going to make no difference. I'm on the wrong subject. Yeah? But if he turns around and says, oh, man, it's going to put 5% on the bottom line, it'll change everything. Okay, so that's a conversation worth having. So then you can narrow down to the subsets within that subject. That's probably all we've got time for on that, Pete.
Yeah. And Tim's posted a very interesting question. Is what if you find the CEO is the problem? But I don't know that we can get into that right now. that is our hour up, and I see people are dropping off, and people are saying thank you very much. And I'll echo that, Keith. That was wonderful, despite the technical challenges we had. I've got a few good reminders. I have heard all this, but it's good to be reminded because I need a bit of a kick up the proverbial every now and then. And what's the follow up in case people want to ask the odd question or you know a real burning?
Just email me.
Yeah, and if you don't know Keith's email, just send it to me and I'll pass it on. Okay. So if you've got a burning question or you want to get in touch with Keith because he's just so awesome. Make contact with either me or Keith if you've got his details. All right. I think we'll wrap it up there. I'm just seeing Sham. Oh, she's asking, would you use IWU for LinkedIn? I think that, well, there's a question. We'll
absolutely.
Yeah. That's the official ending. Keith, do you want to hang around for another 5 or 10 minutes if people want to hang around? Can hang around?
Yep, happy to.
Okay. Tim, did you have a question or a thought that you wanted to put out there?
Yeah, Keith, I was serious about that question because I have a situation at the moment where I did court a CEO for some time and have basically infiltrated the business, really expanded the amount of work that I originally went into to do there because I do have a partner relationship with him. But the other side of it is that he is a big part of the problem. So when you need to be able to do work with a person that is pivotal with your, you know, having been given the work, have you ever come across that, and have you been able to challenge that process? And you think that there?
I think in Australian business in particular at the moment is actually a massive issue across an awful lot of organisations. For the first time, they're having to these, especially if they've come up through the organisation. For the first time, they're facing different challenges. You know, life's been pretty rosy till now, and I've actually got this one, the one I talked about earlier. And I think it's really hard. And I think what I actually start genuinely questioning my own integrity around it. And it's that balance between, I kind of like having this contract. I love the people I work with, but the CEO is the main problem, but he's also my main sponsor.
Yep.
And I will typically challenge them. I will do it in a way that asks a question rather than tells the answer, as I would tend to. And I know you, Tim, you know, your integrity is pretty bloody high. But at some point, so there's one of the big four organizations in Australia I won't work for.
Yeah.
And the reason is, and I told the CEO this, I said, he actually asked me if I'd work with them. And I said, I won't. And he asked me, why not? And I said, because all you care about is money and I can't live with that. And he looked at me and he went, oh, okay. You know, and that potentially would have been $500,000 a year. Mm. But I couldn't do it because I will work with elements where I trust a sub leader within that group and I'm working with the group. And he'll let me because he knows that I'll add value to that. The CEO will let me, but he knows I won't work with the firm as an entity. I think you have to ask the question that makes them reflect on it. And if that costs you the gig, but you've stuck through to your values, I know it's a really hard thing to do. But
yeah, it is. You know, I think also I can help in other areas of the organization, even though he is a pivotal, you know, there needs to be something that changes with him to be able to fix it completely. But I could still fix other or help to fix other areas of the organization.
So fix the bits you can, do what you have to do with him. But you will know where the moment is right where you can't carry on doing what you're doing without having that conversation.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great, thanks.
Right. Anyone else? And I don't know how many of you are, as an aside here, how many of you are think on your feet advocates? But one of the beautiful things about the way that we've worked, not so much within end-to-end, but with Pete, is the synergy between our thinking around it's all about the client and then rolling into Think on Your Feet has been profoundly successful in 2 or 3 clients. Because they then understand that once they've got this relationship with the client, the ability to actually respond to difficult situations, difficult questions, and present in a way that is consistent with how they've gone about building a relationship just works beautifully. Pete didn't ask me to pitch Think on Your Feet, but man, does it work nicely together.
Thanks, Keith. That was a nice endorsement. Yeah, okay. Anyone else got questions for Keith?
If anybody wants, we've got, what I can do is if anyone emails me, I'm very happy to get into phone calls with people, emails with people. If you are intrigued by any of this, I can also point you to the pages and website that have free videos around a lot of the thinking, but also examples of good meetings and bad meetings with clients, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't cost anything. It's just finding the link.
Well, perhaps you can share that with me, and I can send it out when I share that.
Yeah, more than happy to.
Yeah.
Another question, if I may. It's Tim again. Regarding the fact that one of the things that you, I mean, eventually, people sort of know who you are. And I think we may have touched on this question before anyway, is that when you're going to reach out to people, you have something attached to your name. So, you know, you're the author of the book of Smarter Selling. I'm the author of the book of Emotional Judo. I do leadership programs and all of those kind of things. So when you're reaching out to a person at the top, even though what you're saying in your eye where you may be reflective of something that they want to know at that particular time, there's still something that comes as either a credibility or a discredibility, if that's a word, that's attached to you. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I've still got a huge cynicism or skepticism around that, Tim. I've never, ever, ever, ever had a client, when I've met them for the first time, said, oh, yeah, you wrote that book, ever. Mm-hmm. So, never, because it's, I think it's a, I'm just checking my email signature, and I haven't got one at the moment, so that kind of proves that. I'm just checking what it was.
That's you are a technically challenged person.
I am, but yeah, but I've got people who are really good at it working with me. But for some reason, I wonder if it works if I reply. No, I've got no signature from them. I've never hold that in great stead. And as you know, my tendency on all of these things is to take out your labeling and titling and credentials anyway, because what you're trying to do is build a relationship between two human beings. And the more you put in there what it is you do, the more you're narrowing down that box of what they then will think you want to talk about. So business cards, for example, just have my name on. Yeah, of course it says a business of trust, but it just has my name on it. It doesn't say director and owner and author, because that immediately narrows down what I might want to talk about.
Keith?
Yep.
I don't know how this relates or not, but it's kind of a flip on what you do, in the sense that sometimes when we approach new relationships, I actually try and treat them as the experts. So I'll actually ask for their help. Now, I don't know how that would work.
No, absolutely.
I don't know how that would work with senior executives, but it certainly works with the CHROs and learning and development, because they're often asked to do so much. They kind of feel good that they're being treated as an expert or asked for advice.
No, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I will, in my first email to someone, if it's an industry I don't know, an organization I don't know, in there I'll probably say in the IOU somewhere pretty early, I'll say something along the lines of, look, I'll probably get much more out of this meeting than you will. Mm-hmm. So my first part of the week will be, I'd love to hear more about your business because I genuinely don't really understand how it works. I'll be honest about that if that's the case. Then I'll say, you'll probably get much more out of this than I will, but hopefully you will walk away with two or three new ideas that will be of use.
Yeah. So I just did this.
And you know what's really interesting, Peter?
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that does my head in. Senior executives in organizations love talking about their business. Now, yeah, you don't want to go in there as an idiot who's done no research at all. But if you say something like, look, I've had a look at last year's annual report, quite interesting. Your website tells me a bit about it. But honestly, I've got no idea how you turn that rock in the ground into money. Mm. And you watch and go, let me tell you. Or let me go and show you is even better.
Yeah.
But most people don't. They go in there with things they want to tell the client. They'll ask a couple of decent questions in there, but essentially they're there to sell their product.
Yeah.
And the analogy we use, which is kind of a risky one, but as long as you've got the right audience, it works. So I'll use it here, is what you're trying to do in this first meeting is exactly the same, and keep it clean, as you're trying to get in a first date. What is the definition of success of a first date? A second date.
Hmm.
You don't want to walk up to someone on the first date and say, hi, I'd love to buy you a drink, have dinner, spend the night, make your breakfast, get married and have kids. But that's what most people do when they go to a first meeting. They try and flog their product. And we all know how we react when someone does it to us. So why do we then go and do it to someone else?
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I'll lead with things like, you know, I really just want to learn a lot more about your industry or your marketplace if it's in another country that I'm unfamiliar with. Or,
yeah.
You know, and I even might even say, I promise not to sell you a darn thing. You know, I really want to learn from you. And then I'll write something in there about, you know, and in return, I'll try and share something that I've been learning amongst my community that hopefully gives some value to you. But
yeah.
And the response rate is very good, you know.
No, it would be, because you're essentially following the, you know, the similar principles. The only thing I'd push harder on that is the language around not my community, because what I want them to recognize is that I've actually deliberately gone and looked at others.
Yeah, good one. Yeah.
In order to add value in this meeting, not just the things I happen to know from the people I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. A, it's a good thing to do, and B, it always looks good.
Anyone else got any burning ones?
The other area, which if no one has got questions, I'll just dip into, which is, and again, I've not looked at anyone on this call's marketing material, so I've got no idea whether this is relevant to stuff that they have, but marketing materials talking about it are just useless. But I see it everywhere from small businesses to the biggest businesses, talking about how great they are and how great their product is and how great their clients think it is. There is an overlay actually to think any feet in this, and you have to flip that entirely into a historical three-part story of how a previous client benefited in a way from working with you that is similar to the people you're targeting with this marketing material. So let's say you're going to ASTD and you've got your marketing materials and you reckon you're going to have a bunch of HR managers in there. Do the pest analysis we spoke about earlier, identify what's probably top of mind in that industry, and then have your marketing material saying, we worked with this one organization whose main issue was around productivity. What we did to help them with productivity was this, and this is how they told us they benefited in terms of time, money, or comfort from working with us. So you've got this marketing material that is driven by the things that are top of mind for the audience you're trying to speak to, linked to a true historical three-part story with client citations at the end of it that are related back to that issue. And then the reaction from people then as well, often, well, can I go and talk to that other client? And there's your marketing done, because that's what you want, is you want your clients talking to each other.
Yeah, so it's not shotgun, it's very tailored, and it's a story of that's going to relate to them.
Absolutely, true three-part story is related to what they're facing. And it's, you're dead right, it's not shotgun.
Yeah. Virginia's throwing a question in there. How do you allocate your time between business development, being research, reports, approach emails, etc., and the actual meetings with the potential clients?
I would probably, for every meeting I have with a client, where I'm driving the relationship as opposed to when they're driving the relationship from scratch, it's probably a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio. Time spent thinking about it, planning it, writing the email, getting it right, setting it up, and then the meeting. But we're very targeted.
Yeah.
The irony, Virginia, and I know that, I'm not sure, where's Virginia based, Pete?
Hong Kong.
Okay, blimey, perfect. The irony is that once you start getting this reputation with the C-suite around someone that other C-suite people should talk to, you don't actually have to drive much work. I know that sounds kind of kumbaya-ish and idealistic, but I'm trying to think of the last time I tried to drive work from stone cold. And as Pete knows, you know, we're pretty busy. The word gets around, and this is across Australia, well, it's not just across Australia, I get phone calls from Europe as well, got from New Zealand, from a big bank the other day. Because the reputation gets around that person is a good person to talk to, not because of the product. And in somewhere like Hong Kong, which is such a small place, having lived there, that the leaders of business in Hong Kong do tend to know each other. They're all members of the same club. And so, whereas if you're dealing with the HR function, it is much harder yak. There's a high turnover, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks, Keith. Sorry, I just managed to dial in on a different line as well. Can you hear me? It's Virginia here.
I can. Hello.
Great. Hi. Thanks so much for sharing. Super insightful and super helpful. And I completely agree with you. Having I've been in Hong Kong 20 years, and so the network is incredibly strong. What I find challenging, so it works in two ways. So one, definitely your reputation, and I would say 99.8% of our business, I've actually calculated that, is referral. So it's all reputation-based, yeah, to your absolute point, which is why I basically don't do any, my clients do my business development for me, which is phenomenal. What I would also say is that that works, can work against you in terms of getting new clients, because people are very ingrained in organizations and with their, and with the rapport that they have with senior leaders. And so it can be hard, therefore, to, in my experience at least, to cut into that because they already have. So it works for you in terms of your current clients, but can also work against you in terms of business development.
No, I'd agree with you totally and utterly. And I'll be honest, you know, if a competitor has what we would call a true partner relationship with the economic buyers, don't even bother. Yeah, if you're trying to sell a competing product, well, I wouldn't even worry about it. It's just too hard.
Yeah, I've done this. Yeah, exactly. Yes, partnership.
Mm-hmm. It's incredibly rare that that happens. Mostly they've got a technical relationship. They might be dealing with the C-suite, but it's a technical relationship where the C-suite just likes their product. Where you can cut across that, if you give value, so they don't see you as a provider of a better product than your competitor, they see you as a better person than your competitor. Then you can still get across the C-suite. And so as a mindset thing, and it sounds like you're already there, but as a mindset thing, it's in the, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, is your client thinking that they need you as much as you need them? And that's a partner relationship. Whereas in a lot of cases, it's a really good technical relationship. They love the product, but it's not that I need that human being in my life as much as they need me. Yeah, and it's a mindset. And okay, so how do I elevate myself to that relationship where they want me? And I'll give an example. Cameron Douglas here. I don't do any training for him anymore because we've done it all. He calls me in occasionally to do things. But he swears that the day that we basically stopped doing the technical work, he came to me and he said, Keith, I need to keep you in my life because of what you do for me, but I don't need your product. I said, that's cool. So what happens, of course, is he then refers me into all these other places. But there's nowhere on earth he's going to go anywhere else for the thing I do when he needs it again. Those you can cut across. Now, the other issue in something like Hong Kong as well, depending on your client base, is often the C-suite rotating every 3 or 4 years. So that, again, presents opportunity and challenge, doesn't it? So...
Yes, absolutely. And what I would add on to that, thank you so much, Keith. It's like you're reading my 12-year history of business development in Hong Kong, that the opportunity, of course, is that CEO goes to a new, or C-suite generally go to a new organization, and then they become a new client. And we find that that's how actually we get new clients typically, is that the C-suite or the HR, CHRO, also in C-suite, obviously, moves to a new client, and then we, you know, get them as well. Which was super helpful. What I loved about what you said was about the partner relationships. And when we talk to new clients, we always say to them, we don't use the word vendor or supplier. If that's how you are looking as a transaction, we're not the right person for you. We look for long-term partnerships and developing across a whole range of things. And so we nurture those relationships and we do it in a very different way. And most of them are kind of like, oh, I'm not so sure about that, because, of course, they don't know you potentially. They've heard your reputation.
Yeah.
So then obviously you need to develop something to prove, you know, the credibility, and then, you know, it goes from there. So just one more question, if I may, to build on that, is around getting into C-suite through the technical buyer. So sometimes the economic buyer will refer you back to the technical buyer, for example, and then you basically get stuck at the technical buyer. And one of our biggest approaches is to convince the technical buyer for us to do the selling for them internally to the economic buyer. Because if we get in front of the the C-suite or the key decision maker in the business, we will get the job. We know we will get the work because we can, you know, do all the stuff that you've talked about because that's what we do, right? And so it's not about the product then. The product then and all the technical stuff goes back to the HR person. But what's I'd love to hear any tips or recommendations of on approaches of how to convince the technical buyer to set you up for exposure directly to an economic buyer.
We take a slightly different twist, and we may just be playing with words on this. We would say that, you know, if we talk about four types of relationships, social, technical, advocate, and partner, and typically within any organization, forget provider to client, within an organization, typically the relationships are either technical or ad hoc within an organization. So the COO uses and has a relationship with the head of HR, which is technical because they only use them for their technical knowledge. Yeah. Or they're ad hoc because they only use them when they've got an emergency. So what we would do in that situation is work really hard, A, at building a total trust relationship with the technical buyer first, but then help them build a partner relationship with their boss. And that can take a whole raft of different strategies within that. But you can do it really with all of these. This is about building a partner relationship in one or two meetings. It doesn't take time. It takes intent and behavior. And so it's about making the first of all, build a partnership with technical buyer, making them feel good. Then they trust you to tell you what things are like around them and their relationship with their boss, etc. And then you make them look good to their boss. And build that relationship better. So sometimes it's seeding information to the technical buyer around the industry within which they work and the business and how they can then come across as more informed to their boss, so their boss takes them more as a strategic advisor. Because at some point, in a lot of our cases, even though we might have a relationship with the C-suite and we might have a relationship with the technical buyer, in a lot of cases, you still need them to work closely together and you don't want a division there. And I've got this with a major client at the moment. I was introduced to the office managing partner, the big cheese, through a third party, and all of the people who I deal with who are at that kind of senior technical buyer slash almost economic buyer level, so head of client experience and things like that, they never get access to the big cheese. So they came and saw me the other day, seriously irritated that I've been invited to meet the big cheese. Not irritated with me, irritated with the big cheese for inviting me, which is kind of interesting. So I've now got to work really hard to make sure that those two groups build a better relationship with each other, because I do not want to get sandwiched between them both. So I think it's just a twist on what you say around persuading them to give me that access. I want it to be more sustainable. Sometimes they do just give me that access and they say, this is what I want you to do, go talk to them, fine. But I actually want to, because I want to be more sustainable, I want them to actually see greater value in each other and have greater trust between each other. It just makes my life a lot less painful on a long contract. And most of our contracts would run 1 to 4 years, something like that.
Okay, didn't you also once tell me that if you've only just recently met the technical buyer, for example, and you really want to get to the economic buyer, you might ask questions of the technical buyer that they can't answer. And so they kind of almost need to introduce you to the economic buyer.
You've got to do it very carefully, though, because I would only ask those questions. If I ask questions and they don't know, it could go one of two ways. Either they get very protective and become the gatekeeper because they don't want to be exposed, or they go, you need to talk to the boss. It could go one of two ways. So I'd always go gently in that direction, but then give them the information they need to help them have that conversation with their boss.
Okay.
Yep. And I find once you can have those commercial conversations, obviously, Virginia, you're very good at it, is with the C-suite, they love talking to you, and they'd rather talk to you than talk to their own provider, you know, the technical buyer. Because they suddenly when you're outside, coming from outside an organization, you almost by definition have 20% more intellect in their mind, which is weird. I'd love to admit that.
Didn't hear my enormous laugh? I had to unmute so you could hear me laughing at that comment. That's hilarious. Thank you.
Hey, let's call it there. We've gone to 11:30, well, half an hour over for most people. Keith, awesome. Thank you so much. Like I said,
that's fun.
Yeah, like I said to all of you earlier, if you've got more to follow up on, if you've got questions, just send them either to me or directly to Keith.